Time now for the Yahoo Sports College Podcast with Dan Wetzel.
The Spartans and Wolverines are arguing over nothing. Who's little brother? Eventually the Buckeyes show up and it's like dad's home. Everyone shut up.
Pete Thamel.
Hey, let's not let the Rose Bowl continue to screw this up like it has the last 50 years.
And SI's Pat Forte.
I just found a story from 2007 in which Jim Tressel said, "The punt is the most important play in football."
Here's Pat, Pete, and Dan.
All right, quick roll call here. Is everyone sober this time?
Yes.
All right, there you go.
Wait, I only heard one answer.
Well, I'm accused sober of being drunk on the pod. I was not. I was nursing a Bud Light.
Nursing? I don't know.
Deeper into the
nurse. You might nurse differently than other people.
If someone accused you, Dan, that would mean there was some ambiguity surrounding it. There was no ambiguity surrounding it.
Deny the accusation. Insulted by the implication. All right, Pat. We're glad you're doing all right. It was an exciting Derby day. Soup and Sandwich almost won. Soup and Sandwich had the lead, or they're in second place.
Almost won, please. Ended up last. DFL.
Is Soup and Sandwich a boy or a girl?
It's a boy.
Boy, okay.
They were all boys. Know. 19 Colts in this race.
Okay. Soup and Sandwich. Were you nervous?
I said to someone, if Soup and Sandwich had won the Derby, I would want press box video of how apoplectic Pat Forte was. Because Soup and Sandwich was like in second, you know, again, early speed doesn't matter. Yeah, but yeah. I was like, if Soup and Sandwich wins the Kentucky Derby, assuring Pat Forte loses hundreds and hundreds of dollars in bets, it would have been like the single greatest moment in Churchill Downs press box history.
Never concerned.
I was rooting so hard for Soup and Sandwich. More than when I order a soup and sandwich, I wanted this soup and sandwich. What kind of soup and what kind of sandwich do you think it is? That's really, because there's a lot of ambiguity there.
There is. I picture him, especially after watching him fade to last. He's just your garden variety grilled cheese and tomato soup.
Yeah, kind of heavy. That's it. Yeah, starts off good, but then you regret. later because
like that creamy tomato soup.
Yeah, first couple bites are great, but then by the second furlong, it's like, I shouldn't have eaten this. And then by the end, it's just like, this is going to weigh me down all afternoon. All right, well, sorry, Soup and Sandwich. We'll see what Chips and Salsa does next year. They can get in. Did you? Is Derby Day successful for you, Pat? Monetarily, or should we not mention that in case anyone from the IRS is listening?
Oh boy, no! If they're listening, I have all the tickets I need to file for them for losses to offset any future winnings. Because no, it was. I somehow managed to have money on all four of the top four horses that came in, and still didn't cash a ticket because I out-clevered myself left, right, and center. It was a painful thing where, I mean, I watched them all come in and I'm sitting there saying, surely I have this. And I start pulling out tickets. Oh, wait, no. Oh, no. Oh my gosh, I got nothing. I couldn't believe I somehow cashed nothing. And then to make matters far worse, I did a video for twinspires.com saying, you know, take a shot at the superfecta. I'm going to take a shot at the superfecta. Just try it, you know, $24 for a $1 box. My oldest son, Mitchell's friend, who doesn't know how to bet at all, said, that sounds fun, and boxed the top four and won $10,000 because he watched the video. Yeah.
On what bet? $20?
It was $24 bet. Boxed four horses for a buck. He didn't know what he was doing. He just picked them. I don't know how he picked them. Had never bet a super before. I said, Mitch, tell that kid to retire. Tell him to never bet the Derby super again. Never to bet the Derby again, because it's never going to be as good as that.
Well, I've been to the Derby 8-10 times. Spent a lot of time gambling with Pat. I can fully believe Pat bet a ton of money and did not win anything from a decade of experience next to him. Two great Derby traits Patrick's exhibited. One is one of the great horse racing betting phrases, all around it. Oh, I was all around it. That's the golf shot that keeps you coming back for more. You know, when you hit your drive pier on 16 after a horrible day, you're like, oh God, that's why you do it. All around it is like the tease that keeps you going. The other classic Derby betting trait Pat exhibited was he bet so many different ways so much
that he did not actually know if he won or not. Like, that's like, yeah, like when you're ripping through your tickets, be like, nope, yeah, nope, nope. That is a horrible feeling when you're all around it, have gambled all these different ways, and still can't even find a measly winner.
When I go to the track, I like having one horse in a race for that purpose. Like, yeah, because if keep you it have simple. All of a sudden, it's like a mutual fund. You don't know what the hell's going on in the thing. I want to be screaming for soup and sandwich, right? I want to scream and try to win. I don't want to be that confusing, because then you don't really enjoy the race. You don't know who you're rooting for. You got too many. It's like being in too many NCAA tournament pools or too many fantasy teams. Like, you don't know what to do.
Yeah, true.
So
keep it streamlined. Because yes,
I'm a simple person.
It does get stressful when you're spending your whole time now. Who got third? Who got up for third? Who, you know, to see whether you hit the try. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, there's no worse moment when the horse race ends and then you don't know who came in third and fourth when you have like a super bet. And you're like furiously looking on Twitter, and it takes like 12 of the longest minutes of your life for them to flash it up. And it's just like, and like they're doing the, like the jockey interview, and you're like, just cut it out. Tell us who came in third.
I'm supposed to be doing my job and interviewing people. Wait a minute. Who was fourth? I got to know.
NFL draft wrapped up this weekend in Cleveland. The weather got a little better when I left. Take surprise, surprise. SEC set a record with 65 draft picks. 65. The old record was 64 set by the SEC. 65. An impressive haul. I don't know how many Alabama had in this class. I wrote about the Alabama 2017 recruiting class, which is now spawned 8 first rounders.
Just unbelievable.
8. Unbelievable. They have 11 draft picks overall, including their long snapper. They have 5 expected starters on the 2021 Alabama Crimson Tide. Someone's like, what are they? Will they get drafted? I'm like, I'm ruling anybody starting at Alabama out getting drafted. Yeah. So I don't know. I have no mock for 2022, but 8 first rounders. Absolute domination by Alabama. We talked about it the other night. So I went back and listened to the Nick Saban press conference from signing day 2017. This is how he described the class. We feel like we got a couple good, really good safeties, got 4 really good linebackers. We got 3 really good down guys on defense, you know, some offensive linemen, 4 that are good, some really good skilled wide receivers, couple tight ends, couple good running backs, couple good quarterbacks, couple good specialists. 8 first rounders. Couple good quarterbacks is Tua Tagovailoa and Mac Jones.
Yeah. And one a top later, 5 pick, the other top 15.
He later said about them, he described it as, because Jalen Hurts was going to be the starter. He didn't mention either by name. He said, I think it's very important to develop depth at this position. Depth. Yeah. That's what we're calling it.
All Ruggs, 3 of those guys in the NFL.
Smith and Judy were very explosive guys. That's it. Unbelievable. So 65. I think one interesting thing that's held up, I'll give this to a podcast listener. I think I'm going to pronounce it right. Michael Crucy, who last year I wrote a story about how it took like 50 something picks before anyone from Texas and Texas A&M got picked. And it was, again, I think it was the 51st pick this time. At least 6 players from Texas high schools taken ahead of them. And some of those are Bama again. Everyone else is coming in and raiding the state of Texas. That's why Big 12 was down early, although they kind of caught up a little bit late. Any other thoughts from this draft as it played out the last 2 rounds? Anyone you were stunned went late, you know, jumped up and went at a spot or fell through, or anything stands out, Pat?
I think one thing that, you know, that stood out to me was just that North Carolina had a lot of offensive talent and didn't do anything with it in the latter years under Larry Fedora. And then Mac Brown came in and started to unlock those guys. And then you see them start to get picked. Maybe not, you know, top end talent, but Javonte Williams going 2nd round to Denver. Deami Brown getting picked, Michael Carter, Daz Newsome, all offensive guys getting drafted. And then Chaz Surratt, who started his career as a quarterback and then made the rare switch to linebacker and was the first guy picked. You know, I think that it's clear that Mac Brown has had some talent to work with there, did pretty well with it. And now we'll see. They've had some recruiting successes. They've got Sam Howell coming back at quarterback, maybe the best quarterback in college football to start next year. If they can take a next step up, win the division, and compete with Clemson in the ACC.
Well, I think one of my takeaways as we got later in the draft was, if you opted out and then declared and you weren't like a stand on the table first round pick, that the NFL did not take kindly to that. And I feel like there are a lot of guys that, you know, missed an opportunity to play a season of college football and missed an opportunity to improve their draft stock pretty significantly. Sage Surratt comes to mind, the Wake Forest wide receiver who was just a victim of being called a first round pick in like a way too early mock draft. I think it was a Todd McShay deal. He gets talked into not playing this season, then declares, and then all of a sudden he just does not get drafted. So there was always going to be like an information gap because so much of this was happening for the first time. But when you really look at it, Ambry Thomas opted out. He ends up late in the third round. The Michigan corner. There's just a handful of guys that, like, quite frankly, could have gone back and just had a better experience and gotten a lot better at football, and really didn't do themselves any favors by taking the year off.
Also interesting, you know, this was a year where everybody could have come back. Even seniors, because you were given that extra year because of COVID, correct? You get an extra year of eligibility, and then a lot of the underclassmen went. Normally, usually about 30 come out and don't even get drafted. Now, I don't know that it matters if you're drafted in the 6th, 7th round or you're an unrestricted free agent. In a lot of ways, you can pick maybe a better spot. It's going to be on you making a team, but it is interesting that particularly in a year when everyone had an opportunity to come back, you still had so many guys just sort of jump into the NFL with very little guarantee that this was going to work. I don't know how you get around that. I don't know if you should. I'm a believer in letting people make their mistakes, but it's got to be a frustrating time when you either chose not to come back for that last year or bailed early, thinking something really good was going to happen on draft day, and it didn't.
You know, Pete, to your point, you did see people, too, that used that year really to help themselves. I mean, I don't know whether Zaven Collins, people were talking about him that much before 2020, and he blows up. Zach Wilson, heck, you know, I mean, I think we were all kind of intrigued by him, but it wasn't until you saw him playing more and putting up the numbers that he did, I think, that turned him into somebody like, hey, maybe a first-round pick into the second pick in the draft. So, you know, I don't want to tell anybody they made a bad decision by not playing in a pandemic. You know, that's a very personal decision, but there's no doubt that it helped some and hurt some, whether or not you played or didn't play.
Yeah, and I guess I'm second guessing the not playing and then declaring as opposed to not playing and coming back.
Yeah,
to potentially improve your stock. And here's the thing. If you didn't get drafted in the 6th or 7th round this year, you ain't ever getting drafted because there's only about a third of the players just in the pool. I mean, I'm talking to scouts and front office people last couple of days, like they were just like, these 7th round picks are worthless, basically, because there's just was so few humans. I mean, look, Dan, even your guy from UMass got picked in the 7th round. Learned
hey now,
Coleman.
Hey now.
So
one more reason to donate.
Sleeper.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. So I just really think that, it'd be interesting. It'd be interesting going forward. Cause now next year you would assume is a loaded NFL draft, right? Because you have all these guys coming back. I was doing some casual super senior Googling today. You've got teams with 17, 16 super seniors coming back. Illinois has the most of the Power Five from some light Googling. Arizona State has a bunch. I mean, Utah State has more than anyone else. So you're really going to – there's going to be a lot of men who are going to sign with agents and try to get in the draft process. So it's going to be – more competitive to get in the Senior Bowl, more competitive to get in the Combine, more competitive for all these ancillary all-star games. It's going to be really setting up to be a really fascinating draft process for next season because I would imagine there's going to be closer to 3,000 guys, right? Because so many guys are going to be leaving college at the same time.
All right. Let's each give one late round kind of, I don't know, third round and back, I guess, sleeper that you think – Pete has his all sleeper team out on Yahoo Sports, or all underrated team, I think it's called. All underrated. I'm sorry. Give us one guy. And then, Pat, you can pick one guy you think is a late round pick that kind of popped and you go, you know, that's a really good football player. And I think he'll be really intriguing, even though he's in those middle rounds. You want to start, Pete?
Yeah, so I'm going to first of all point out that I was very happy the all underrated team had a punter. When somebody brought up a punter to me on text message, I got very excited. James Smith, the Cincinnati punter, undefeated in the regular season, quote, he's one of the best punters I've seen. He can put the ball anywhere. There's virtually no touchbacks, and you can count on pinning them back. As an athlete, he feels pressure and can adjust tempo as needed without impacting results. Also, a big leg. And it's an old Ohio State special, Coach Fickell to Coach Vrabel, because he went to the University of Cincinnati, ends up with the Titans. As for perhaps a more applicable late round pick, I'll give you one. This was of all the guys I texted and all the guys I queried, the undrafted guy who got the most buzz for, like, this guy is a no-brainer, is going to play in the NFL for a lot of years, was Drake Jackson, the center from Kentucky. Not to be confused with the Drake Jackson who will be in next year's draft, who's, I believe, a D lineman for USC. Man, did people love Drake Jackson, the center from Kentucky, just raving over and over beyond. One O-line coach said he studied him on film, and he was so impressive making adjustments at the line of scrimmage that they tailored their game plan around two things he adjusted at the line of scrimmage. So that is about as deep in the weeds as you can possibly go in the NFL draft. We're giving you the punter. We're giving you the center. Pat, save us.
I can't top that. I have no undrafted center I can throw out there for you. But the guy that I watched play a fair amount, who I thought was a really good player playing with quarterbacks who were only okay, that I think he's going to look better in a pro offense with really good quarterbacks throwing to him, is Des Fitzpatrick, receiver from Louisville. He's 6'2". He's tall. He can make contested catches. He can make tough catches. His stats, you know, didn't blow you away during the year. He was a fourth-round pick of the Titans, I should point out. And the Titans need playmakers who aren't named Derrick Henry. Fitzpatrick averaged 19.4 yards a catch this year, 18 last year. I mean, he makes plays downfield. And again, we'll catch the contested ball, can defeat a defensive back to get it. So I think that's a really nice pickup for a Titans team that is kind of unspectacular throwing the ball and making plays through the air.
All right, I'm going to go with this, and I don't know how good he's going to be or not, but it's an interesting pick. It was Davis Mills, the Stanford quarterback in the third round, former five-star recruit to Stanford. He was the number one player at the position. He was a huge recruit for Stanford. Knee injuries really wiped out his college career. He's only played, I think, 13 or 14 games, has never quite shown all that he can be, but shows those flashes. The interesting part is he's going to Houston. And Deshaun Watson is going to the likelihood of Deshaun Watson being suspended at least for part, if not all of the season, increases by the day as this goes on. I don't know he'll ever play in Houston again, even if he's not suspended for good. Houston is all of a sudden a wide open job. They have Tyrod Taylor and they draft Davis Mills. I'm not be surprised if Davis Mills gets an opportunity to show what he has. And I think he's an intriguing prospect at that spot. I certainly don't think he's going to be – I wouldn't have taken him in the first round, but just the fact that he went to Houston, that a guy with that much natural ability and potential is there. So I'm going to be interested to watch that one. That's a little more name brand, bold face than Pete's snore fest.
His punter in his center? Come on.
Hey, you have to know your role, right? Do your job. Okay.
Remember, there was a
Dan's going to pick the five star who everybody's heard of.
I'm the shiny object.
Pat's going to pick the guy from Louisville, and I'm going to be.
That's all right.
Yes. Outlandishly obscure.
I remember there was a BCS championship game. I can't remember which one that Ohio State was at, and it was media day. Tressel sent his punter to, you know, they at the media day. It's not like Super Bowl media day, but it was a small media day. Four star players would get a podium and you could surround, you know, so that you could get a lot of questions in. And he put his punter up there. All the great players in this Ohio State team, he had him try to stash all those guys. And one of his four spots was a punter. And then I wrote a column about it. I tried to get the punter to say something. I mean, if there's one position you can trash talk, it's punter. Like, I'm absolutely going to try to pin him deep, and he wouldn't do it. Am I trying to pin him at the one? I'm just going to go out there and execute. And, you know, like, could we
take
be more
one punt at a time?
Yeah, right. It's three offensive linemen and a punter. And we're like, this is boring. This media day sucks.
We need There's nothing more on brand for Tressel than A, bringing the punter, and then B, the punter being boring and saying
it was phenomenal. He wouldn't go. I'm like, there's no, you're not really trashing anybody if you say you're going to punt well. That's, it's just you punting. You're not like, you're not ridiculing the other punter. And he's like, nah, wouldn't do it. Wouldn't do it. So God bless Tressel Ball, man. God bless Tressel Ball.
Man loved his punts. I'm trying to think what year it was where I covered an Ohio State-Iowa game in Columbus where the winner won the Big Ten. And it was Kirk Ferentz and Jim Tressel on kind of an iffy weather day, and it was just who could punt most and who could punt last and who could pin the other guy deepest. And the game was just, I mean, it was just stultifying to watch. And the best thing, after it was over, we did the press conferences, and Tressel, I saw him leaving the stadium with his wife was driving a Prius. He was sitting in the shotgun seat eating a sandwich. I'm like, there, Jim Tressel, we're getting ready to go celebrate a Big Ten title, baby. Living large.
Hold the mayo.
Ohio State just lives off this like endless, like it's like a factory in like Kettering, Ohio or something that produces these big legged, no talk punters. They just churn them out every 4 years.
Yeah. I hope Ohio State fans like hit their knees to the ground every night and thank God how that program's image have changed. They just had a receiver today, Jameson Williams, transfer to Alabama because he was not going to get enough snaps at Ohio State. Now, Ohio State has a ridiculous receiver room right now. Brian Hartline's recruiting better individually at a position than anyone in the country. Ryan Day has these electric offensive schemes. You've had these like back-to-back-to-back dynamic quarterbacks. You're in title contention every year. But like watching Ohio State, like you get excited to watch Ohio State football when you think about it.
Yeah, they're fun. They're fun.
Yes. And they were not fun at all under Tressel. I mean, they were just not fun at all. Yeah, you have Garrett Wilson. You have Chris Olave. You've got Jackson Smith and Ajigba. You've got like guys are going to play on Sundays for a decade, like waiting their turn. And before, I mean, you have really good players, but they just didn't quite there was no sizzle there at all.
I just found a story from 2007 in which Jim Tressel said, "The punt is the most important play in football."
Yeah. Ryan Day will not be quoted saying that.
Those Buckeye fans would defend that to the death 10 years ago. Now, yeah, they're laughing. But they,
what are you talking about?
One team that is not soaring with talent, Michigan State Spartans.
Woo! Wah, wah.
Nobody drafted for the first time in 80 years. Tough times. Beast Lansing has fallen apart. Michigan and Southern California have the longest streaks of 83 straight years of NFL drafts with the leech of player. They're also Florida is the other school that's had someone drafted since 1967, the merger. Spartans had somebody every year since 1940. And they also went 0 for that 1938 team. Yeah, that team sucked. Pour one out for Sparty. He had nothing to do this weekend. Tell you the rebuilding job they got there. Mark D'Antonio really was just stealing the money at the end, wasn't he? I mean, how do you not get one guy at Michigan State? One kid from Ohio or Michigan or Chicago. Not one guy. Couldn't even find a punter.
That has become painfully clear now. I mean, like this draft is the final indictment of that.
Yeah, there were no bullets left. I just thought there was like an assembly line of those guys coming through like every year. Like there's none of those left. I will say this, and our faithful longtime listeners will probably like we saw this Mark D'Antonio Michigan State collapse coming a long time ago, right? Like we had been talking about it. We saw it lined up. We knew Mel Tucker was going to struggle this year, and look, like it's not magic why these programs that have been successful dip. I mean, Texas just had this no draft thing when Charlie Strong was there a couple of years ago. And it's not the fault of the coach who inherits the bad roster. It's like now you have to be creative and work around it. So, but yeah, God bless Michigan State fans. Like they had such a good run there with D'Antonio, and he did such a great job for a while. And then he stopped and their recruiting stunk and the staff kind of fleed and it just kind of sputtered to them. Remember, he like stayed too long and they got rid of him in January. Like that just like that undercuts
that
years.
That killed recruiting. Plus, remember when reassigned the staff? Instead of getting a new staff, he just made like the linebacker coach became the tight end coach and the tight end coach became the
– Yes.
Yes.
Like everyone got a new job, but it's like reorganizing a restaurant. Duck. Yeah, now all of a sudden the dishwasher is the sous chef. Like, that's not how it works around here. I can't imagine great talent didn't look at that plan in Michigan State and say, I think I'll go to Purdue. I think I'll look at more. Michigan coach Ryan Osborne mocked this this draft, 80-year draft break. This is all Michigan and Michigan State have to argue about anymore. He tweeted out, hate to see it go blue, because State ended, which many people responded, a scoreboard, since Michigan actually lost to a team with no draft picks.
Correct.
God, it they is did. Sad around here, man. It is sad. That's all I can say. Ohio State's down there just swimming in everything. The Spartans and Wolverines are arguing over nothing. They're whose little brother? And then eventually the Buckeyes show up and it's like, dad's home. Everyone shut up.
Well, let's think about this with Michigan State. Like, I'd be stunned if someone gets drafted next year. Can either of you name a Michigan State Spartan?
I think they all
transferred. Who was the quarterback who came in? He was a freshman. Peyton Thorne. He came in, ran around some when Rocky Lombardi clearly couldn't do it.
Oof, Rocky Lombardi. Oof.
Yeah, you know.
Oof.
All right, let's move on to playoff talk. Great story by Ross Dellinger, Pat's colleague at SI.com. Encourage everyone to go read it. College football playoff decision makers. Basically, let's see, it says inside 27 months of playoff expansion discussions and the arduous path ahead. So this story, Ross talked to pretty much all the conference commissioners. I think all of them. 10 out of 11, including the Notre Dame.
Who stiffed him?
I can't say, but I know who it is.
Okay. Okay.
All right.
All right. Oh, I didn't know if it was named or not. I haven't read it yet. I will. I'm reading it now.
Okay. Very good. That's good. Good show prep. Good job there. No, it basically says, man, what is it? 8 of the 10 are either in favor a playoff or open to it. Nobody is opposed. Just 2 are kind of neutral. It's again, classic. Like, and I Bill Hancock is in here who runs the playoff. He is basically the entire story saying this isn't going to, I don't get too far ahead of yourself. And then Ross is like, yeah, I talked to all the AD, all the commissioners. They're like, it's happening. Why are they so opposed? This whole thing baffles me. First of all, they should have leaked that they were thinking about this like this week after the draft and basked in a week of everyone talking about college football. Instead of they try to hide these stories about that gets America talking about college football. Like, why would you do this? And then why would you continually say it's not happening or something close to it? When someone's trying to hype up your sport, like, hey, this might happen, when it's demonstrably untrue, it's probably going to happen.
And we've discussed this on here before, that these are people who are so averse to change and so unwilling to be the one that steps out on the branch and says, yeah, we're heading that way. And then has to, you know, deal with the 18 text messages from the other commissioners and people behind the scenes saying, did you really say that? Are you saying that? Why would you say that?
They are saying that in this story, basically.
Well, yeah, that most of them are unnamed that are saying that.
Yeah, but why not leak this out this week and have all of the ESPN programming, all the talk radio around the country, all the websites? We have nothing. We don't have an NFL draft, so we got nothing to talk about.
Right. Spring practice is over.
Right.
Pretty much everywhere. And then
bask in a week of everyone arguing whether it should be 8 teams or 6 teams or 10. Like, it's good. Yeah. You want people talking about your sport. You know, it's not like there's no negative here. And then come up with whatever number you want. But instead, it's like, this isn't happening, or I'll get too far ahead. Anyway, it's happening, according to this story. And it's really just a question of what. The 2 things that seemed interesting to me is they talk about 8 to 12. 12 possibly needed to have more than 2 at-large bids to really open it up. Now, the problem is you now add an extra weekend to the thing. How do you fit that in? But 12 is not out there. I think they're throwing 16 and 12 out so that people don't get scared when it comes to 8. It's kind of just a basic marketing trick. Sure. The other things I saw in here, everyone is on board with the first round on a home site, which I've needless to say, I've been pushing for freaking forever. Yeah, it's going to be fantastic if that happens. It also, as I forever was arguing, it improves the importance of the regular season because you want to host a game And the other was almost everyone is in favor of a group of five automatic spot. So I thought those three developments were really interesting, and I'm in favor of all of them. Again, automatic bids and all this stuff. So that's what I took from it. Pat, you have read it. I'll let Pete keep reading. what's your takeaway from this very well-reported story?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was it got a little bit inside the room as far as what the mindset is. And the mindset is clearly that this is more likely, I would say, than unlikely that we end up with 6-8. And as you said, 8-12 might be the sweet spot in there. And I think all the changes that are discussed here, as you noted, would be potentially really good ones. And the big drawback, as is mentioned, is, you know, the fitting it into the schedule as far as the weeks and everything. Look, there that argument died last fall. You know, like with finals, we can't be intruding on finals. Oh, yes, you could. When you made teams play meaningless, worthless games on like December 12th and 19th in the middle of finals or at the end of finals so you could fulfill TV contracts. So I don't want to hear that anymore. Pushing to week zero, having everybody play week zero, basically making the season start a week earlier, as opposed to just having one or two games in that first weekend, last weekend of August, is another possibility. So that's the thing they've got to do is basically figure out the calendar as it relates to the NFL playoffs, and then pretend you care about academics as far as finals and just make it work. But I think those things are going to happen. I would not be surprised if we end up with 8 or 12. Either one, I think, would be fantastic. And I think, yeah, campus games is going to happen. And we're getting there. Now, why? I just think, Dan, I just don't think these people think that way. There is so little, first of all, there's so little cohesion between the conferences. So it's not like, I don't think they are even capable, really, of getting together and hatching a plan of like, hey, how should we publicize some potential changes to the playoff? Because they don't talk to each other about those things, and the people in charge don't think that way. So that's why this stuff all of a sudden comes dribbling out on a Friday leading up to the NFL draft like it did, what was now, a week and a half ago.
And then instead of embracing it and letting it run wild because it's a positive, it's all stomp on it.
Yeah.
Like, someone hire me to market this sport, please. Like, I mean, this stuff's just easy. It's just like, what are you doing? Why? Yeah. I mean, it's a funny story. It's a funny story because it's like, here are all the insiders saying we're working hard at this. And then here's the official spokesman saying, I don't know.
The official spokesman who did put it in the release to begin with. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then was worried on the Friday. I don't know. Go ahead, Pete.
You have to remember, this is the same group that when they first wanted to propose a playoff, I remember, God rest his soul, Mike Slive and I laughing about this. They wouldn't call it a playoff. They called it a plus one.
Yeah.
Because the pearl clutching over the world playoff, they thought would like alienate the presidents. So they were just going to trick them and just call it a plus one. And it was just like that nonsensical thinking has permeated all the way through now, almost two decades later. And that's still where we are now. It's there's still playoff fear. There's no other way to say it. Like some president's going to pick up the New York Times and see that the playoff may expand and shutter the whole thing. But this speaks to an interesting tension of where we are, like with Mark Emmert and his contract extension. Well, first of all, everyone afraid to say it's a good thing. This is the same group of people who are afraid to say out loud that Mark Emmert's doing a terrible job, even though all of the commissioners think Mark Emmert is doing a terrible job. And yet the Board of Governors, who actually are presidents who run the thing, gave him a contract extension the other day. And people were aghast, but no one's going to say anything out loud about it. And so there is just, and maybe it's some of our faults too, because we allow people the veil of anonymity. And this isn't like what Ross did. I do this quite often too. I'm sure Pat's done it, Dan's done it. But it is interesting that like there's no earnest and honest conversation. It's all whispers in back rooms and then it deflect. That's the way the college football postseason has always operated, which is one way to say it's always operated kind of backwards.
I like to refer to that as Delaney think, because that's just his, you know, the one guy who's like, no, this is not happening. And there's that continual resistance to an actual discussion of expansion of a playoff. I mean, just, you know, you just give up ground inch by inch and you never confront it or take it on other than behind closed doors.
Well, I'll be curious to see as we evolve here whether the Bulls are included in this or not. Because
right.
I would imagine, and certainly Dan's written a book about this, right? So I can't claim to be the expert, but you know, the line I always remembered from Dan's reporting on this and his book on this was like, the NFL wouldn't outsource the wild cards to like a random stadium in Indianapolis or in Dallas, right? So why are you outsourcing your most valuable product? So putting campus sites is a really good way to start nudging the Bulls. Now, look, there's a place for Bulls. Like, we should have all the .com, random, Bitcoin, Micron, PC, Weed Eater, GalleryFurniture.com. I want them all. Bring them all in. Bring them in with the undrafted punters and centers, all right? Like, they just don't have to be part of the playoff because they're probably getting in the way of how you make money. So don't let – like, here should be the goals of all these commissioners when they sit around. Hey, let's not let the Rose Bowl continue to screw this up like it has the last 50 years, all right? If these commissioners let the Rose Bowl screw up the future of the playoff, they should all be fired, all right? It is inexcusable to let the Rose Bowl, a sunset, and a parade still dictate the future of a billion-dollar sport. They should all be shuttered, gone, if they still allow the Rose Bowl in its time slot to dictate the future of the sport. It just shows they're completely incompetent at their jobs if they don't make the Rose Bowl adjust to them as opposed to them adjusting to the Rose Bowl, which they've done so many times. And it's just the most preposterous thing. They need to grow up. They need to evolve. They need to move on.
It does mention that this could get done in 2 years. There was no and that would include the keeping the Bowls as a semifinal site, presumably, or they could wait longer and just play this out. It's really going to be a question of what's the greater value. Do the Bulls and ESPN want to just pay right now and lock themselves in, maybe give more advantageous deals or whatever? Or do you want to risk that? So I think that's some of the play involved here. But after 9 years, which would be the 2022 season, all six Bulls will have made three rotations through. So there is a kind of a break point there for years 10, 11, and 12 of the contract that they may want to switch. So that could be interesting. That probably is the most interesting part, is that this could be done in, like, we could have two more years of the 14 playoff and that's it. So I think here's the quote from one commissioner. I don't think ESPN or the Bulls would mind basically restructuring mid-contract. They'd be licking their chops. It's an opportunity for them to secure their position. So again, this could happen pretty quickly.
Yeah.
All right. PJ Fleck is coming up with Pete. Good interview. But first, I mean, some stories just have to get squeezed in here, even if this pod goes a little long. Talk about a bad day. Let's just put it that way. You think you're having a bad day? You might be. But imagine this one. Authorities say, according to the AP, say a man was rescued after a tree that fell during high winds trapped him inside a portable toilet at the Gettysburg National Military Park. At Gettysburg, his own personal Gettysburg. A tree trapped a man inside a portable toilet. The Barlow Volunteer Fire Department said it had to send a crew. They found the tree atop a vehicle, but no one inside. And park rangers then told them the tree trapped a man inside the portable toilet. Said they treated it like a car entrapment, cutting away the tree with a chainsaw, then cutting the portable toilet open with another saw. He was very lucky, said Robinson. It was a large tree, just missed striking him. So definitely did not get injured, but...
like, absolute life rule is to spend as little time as possible in portable toilets in any circumstance, in any place. To be trapped in one, and hopefully it didn't tip over. That doesn't seem, I don't know whether that says whether it was like knocked over and perhaps any of, yeah, like the sewage was on the loose of any kind or not. But just as a rule, I do not like portable toilets. Nobody should. The only good thing that I can think of that's ever happened in a portable toilet is when Desmond Ridder, the Cincinnati quarterback, got his offer from Cincinnati, he was in a portable toilet at the Kentucky Oaks because he was from Louisville. That's a whole other story.
It all goes back to He was in Tommy Tuberville called him. Called?
Tommy Tuberville called him. He's at the Oaks in the infield having a good time. He's like, I can't hear. He has to go in the portable toilet to take the call.
It's true.
Was he all around it?
Yeah. He's all around it.
Really was. But no, yeah, I mean, that is not good. Don't be trapped in a portable toilet. Yet many worse things have happened at Gettysburg than what happened to him, but that's not good.
So here's my thought. Like, if this happened to one of us, most portable toilets, the toilet seat doesn't have a cover, right? It's just like the seat's right. Down.
Yeah.
So say you're right side up and you're in there for a while. Do you sit on the bowl or do you stay standing up? I would think you got to stay standing up, right?
Yeah. You stay as far away from any of the stuff that's down there as you can.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm seeing pictures after cut away, but like this thing was annihilated. There was splash.
Really?
There was splash.
Oh boy.
There's no way there wasn't splash.
If our listeners could just see the look of sheer mischievous delight on Dan's face as he said there was splash.
I'm reading this. Apparently there's a Twitter feed called Civil War Humor.
Oh no.
At Civil War Humor. I mean, who knew? I'm going to read some more because I'm going to check this thing out, but let me just read this one. Apparently you can have a worse day at Gettysburg than Pickett did. Civil War humor. All I know is if I'm one of the Gettysburg firefighters rescuing this guy from the porta potty, I'm definitely yelling bayonets when we bring out the Sawzall. What? Civil War humor.
Civil War humor. Oh, my God.
I had no idea.
These are all like American history majors chortling over their little Civil War jokes, you know?
Unbelievable stuff. Wow, there's a whole bunch here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of posts. I'm not just going to blindly read these. I'm not sure these are. I don't need to get fired.
Yeah, try not to.
I don't know. Anyway, yeah, Civil War humor. I would take a shower for like a week after that. Ugh. Like, I mean, yeah.
Other people's. Yeah. No.
I'd almost rather do the Steve-O where they stuck him in like the Porter John and launched him on a bungee cord, in one of the Jackass movies, because that's over in a couple minutes. Like this, you're stuck at like, he's stuck in there for a while. Like, ooh, could not imagine.
And not only that, you're stuck in there. You don't know whether you can get out or what it's going to take to get you out. If this, you know?
Oh, let's get to Coach Fleck. I mean, no better way to lead a guy in than that.
Yeah. Coach Fleck wrote a book with John Gordon. That's why we're having him on. So
all right.
He also had his 400-pound offensive lineman throw a touchdown in the spring game. So we need more of that.
Love it.
Oh, wait. One spring game note. I don't know if you saw the Kansas spring game. If you did, God help you. It is a chance for Kansas to win a game.
Not high on my viewing list, though, I have to say.
Yeah, if you were watching the Kansas spring game, at the end, they give a trophy out to the white team got it. I don't know what they are. But this trophy.
They were loaded this year.
Yeah, this blue team was not happy.
Nobody was ever loaded at the Kansas spring game.
The only team that can't beat Kansas is Kansas. Anyway, their spring game trophy in this picture is like Marlia Campbell, who's a reporter out there. It's like 15 feet tall. You see this trophy? You guys looking at the picture?
15 feet tall. No. Hang on. A giant truck. Wait a minute. Kansas has a really big trophy for spring game.
It's like roughly 12 feet tall. It is believed to be a 12-foot tall trophy that they give out to the winner. And it's got a whole bunch.
Oh, my God. It's like a pole vault.
Yeah. It's the biggest trophy I've ever seen in my life. Except, who gets that Paul Bunyan? Is that Michigan or Michigan State? Things like 800 pounds or something? This is just tall. It looks like it could get knocked over in a stiff wind, which there's plenty of in Kansas. But what? Look at that.
Where do you put it? Where do they store it?
The Kansas trophy case isn't exactly full, so they got
no, that's true. But like, what closet is tall enough for like a 12-foot high trophy?
I don't know, but congratulations to white team for winning this massive trophy. I don't know what to say.
I mean, the jokes basically write themselves for Kansas football spring game trophy. I mean, holy moly.
I didn't even know they gave out trophies for spring games. Anyway, all right, let's go to Jacob Stewart. Jacob Stewart, a podcast listener, sent me that. So, and thank you for that. All right, let's get to Fleck.
PJ is the co-author of a new book, Row the Boat, A True Story with Principles and Lessons to Transform Your Culture. And that makes him the one published author on this podcast right now. PJ, tell us a little story about how you came to write a book.
Well, we're going right into that, huh? Going right into it.
Yeah.
I like it.
Let's start.
Pete, thanks for having us on the show. It happened during quarantine back last April. John Gordon and I were kind of on the phone. I've known him for a long time. Love the type of books he writes. They're short, simple, and to the point. Got talking and thought about possibly writing a book during what we were doing. I mean, it didn't take that long to write. A few mornings of my time to kind of get nuts and bolts of all of it. So it's not the reason why we went 3-4. So everybody understands that. Like I spent more than being a coach. It didn't take that long, but we wanted to be able to do something that benefited Masonic Children's Hospital here at the University of Minnesota, where Row the Boat really benefits. And writing and telling the story about Row the Boat and how people can use Row the Boat in their lives to be able to spread hope, love, positivity, culture, and togetherness. And I think it was a perfect fit for what we were going through at our country during our country's times. And this isn't to save that or anything. It's just, it was a perfect time to be able to write one. And I know a lot of coaches write them after winning national titles and doing things. This isn't about just winning, losing games. It's more of a lifestyle and a never give up type attitude and be able to create some type of positivity. And like we said, love and hope and togetherness and some culture along the way. So it was a lot of fun. I never knew what it was like to write a book before. There's a lot of things that go involved in that. And I said this before. I mean, I got an 18 on my ACT, and I think I got a 15 in the reading and writing part. So that's why you team up with John Gordon. He's one of my favorite authors and a wonderful human being.
How'd you meet John Gordon, PJ? He's a guy a lot of coaches have really connected to over the years. I wonder if you can give us a little insight into what attracted you to John, and then just how did that relationship start?
Yeah, first of all, just John's books in general. I've read them my entire coaching career, my playing career. I mean, he's one of the best in terms of short, simple, positive, to the point. There's always a story behind it, and you can fit it into your life somehow, some way. I got a chance to meet him a few times, being on some of his podcasts that he has, and then we started talking here and there through texts, talked through through phone at times, and then just became somewhat pretty close. And just kind of were on the phone one day and decided to kind of bring it up. Would you ever be interested in writing a book? And I said the same thing to him. And it just, we both gave it some time to think about, because, you know, you don't want to be, you know, I'm not sitting there saying, hey, how do you go 3-4? You know, this is how you do that. It's not about that. This is more one, it's for the children in Masonic Children's Hospital. And during our pandemic, to know that those children only have one parent at the time, per time inside in their room, can't leave, can't have visitors. And we're going to do everything we have. Our mission here has been to raise as much money as we possibly can for the Children's Hospital. And this is no different.
So when you were at Western Michigan, obviously you had a great relationship with the hospital in Kalamazoo. And you and Heather have forged one with the Masonic Children's Hospital there. A lot of people, one of the big misnomers about Row the Boat is that it's sort of tied to you, but it's really tied to the community, which I think is one of the things that maybe has gotten lost a little bit over the years. I wonder if you can just go inside a little bit into how the Row the Boat culture that you obviously have had and made famous at Western Michigan and now at Minnesota really ties your program to the community.
Yeah, I think that when you become a head football coach, obviously you kind of dive into a community. And for me, I've always wanted it to be bigger than football, period. I want it to be bigger than the wins and the losses and the story of the fields and the narrow margins to victory and things like that. I wanted it to be bigger than that. I always have. You know, you have a short time to be a head football coach in your life. I look at it that way, because you're never promised tomorrow. So you've got to do everything you can to be able to, you know, bring a community closer together. And I think as a public figure, that's especially from a state university, that's part of our job. But I love that part. You know, my whole goal at Western Michigan and my whole goal at the University of Minnesota was to get people who even hate football to love how we run our program and how we run our culture. Not going to make everybody happy. You might not do it how everybody likes it, but you want the people who maybe weren't even fans of Minnesota before to really like how you run your program and the positivity and the culture that we have with this. And I think that's been our mission as a head coach and as a program since we started back at Western Michigan.
So this weekend, you had two former Gopher players get drafted to the NFL. Obviously, Rashad Bateman went in the first round to the Baltimore Ravens. One of your corners, Benjamin St. Juste, I believe, went in the third round. You've obviously had a lot of players drafted over the years. You know, Corey Davis, most notably from when you were at Western, I believe, was the third pick in the draft a few years back. Just what's that feeling like, PJ, when you can guide a young man through your program and then see him go off and fulfill his dreams on draft day?
Yeah, I mean, you make promises to all these players, right? I mean, when you recruit them and you say, hey, listen, the definition of a coach, right? A stage coach, right? It's taking someone from where they are to where they want to go. And as a coach, that's the same thing. We want to be able to take these young men from where they are to where they've always dreamed to be, whether that's a first pick in the NFL draft, first rounder, second rounder, free agent, going to the NFL, not going to the NFL, going to be a doctor, a lawyer. I mean, our starting left guard just got a 5.18 on the MCAT. He's in the 96th percentile, came back for a 6-year just to be in the culture again. So whatever their dreams and hopes and aspirations are, we want to be able to fulfill that as a university, as a community, and definitely as a football coach. And those are the most enjoyable times when you see that person get to where they dreamed of being. On the field, off the field, teachers, lawyers, doctors, social worker, NFL player. Those are the most fulfilling parts of our job. And they really are. I can't tell you a lot of the scores of games we've won in that you can remember the next day and then forget. But you can remember those lives that you keep touching. And our program continues to do that. And you know, our university does the same.
Let's peek ahead to the season, PJ. And I think the next critical period for coaches coming up is June. You obviously haven't had anyone formally visit your campus in terms of recruits for 14, 15 months now, I would think. June almost feels like the Oklahoma land rush, like all these recruits are waiting on the outside and then they're going to start flowing into these programs. How are you approaching this sort of most unique cycle of recruiting as things start to open back up in the country?
Well, everybody's really excited to get out. I think it's like a big expansion west, right? I mean, it's exactly what you said. Everybody just can't wait to go. But this year is a little bit different. I think for most teams in the country, the amount of limited scholarships people are going to have, you know, with being over the 85 for 1 year, then you got to be back down to the 85 and how many older players you have, how many people transfer, how many people transfer in. The transfer portal's changed a lot. And I think people have this negative narrative at times at the transfer portal. It's there for the student athlete to be able to make an experience better, go play somewhere else, have a better fit. That's okay if it benefits the student athlete. I think sometimes we just think of it as a negative narrative. But I think that when you look at this year, how different it's going to be, it's based on the individual university. We might not have that many scholarships left. Some might have a lot. So not only are you getting out and evaluating now, but you're also evaluating guys for the next recruiting class as well. And I think that's what you're going to be able to see. You're going to be able to see people evaluating not only for the 22 class, but the 23 class as you go forward. But it's exciting. I know that. I'm not comparing this to war whatsoever, but it's kind of like a deployment. I mean, we're going to leave for 3 weeks and we might not come home. I think everybody's just really excited to get out on the road and get back to one of those enjoyments of the job is the recruiting and going out and visiting different places and holding camps and doing the live evaluations, which we haven't had in a long time.
So this 2022 recruiting class in general is going to be one of the most unique because the transfer portal has been in effect, but now one-time transfer has become formally passed. It was sort of informally passed for 2 or 3 years. Philosophically, PJ, you have obviously three high impact transfers on defense. They all start in your spring game this weekend. Philosophically going forward, how do you balance scholarship allotment to recruits for scholarship allotment to players in the portal right now? I mean, are we about to undergo a wholesale change in how programs operate?
Well, there's no doubt about it. Now, I think people are going to still be able to they're going to go on their philosophical beliefs. You know, I think it's for us, it's not going to change us a lot, but it will change us a little bit. You know, we proved that this year. I even said in recruiting, people can ask, how many guys are you going to take? How many guys are you going to take? Well, we're probably going to take, you know, 16, 17, 18 high school kids, and then we're going to leave it open for 5 or 6 transfers. And I see that staying true for us around those numbers each year. If you have a class of 24, 25, if it's on a lower end, you might see that a little bit different. And when you have a little bit less scholarships, but you might see people do a wholesale change where they strictly just go to the portal system, which we've seen a little bit with some teams already that have made that public. You might see teams that might not believe in that at all. We don't know how it's going to affect your team. Sometimes you might lose 5-6 kids. Sometimes you might lose 20 kids in a year. You don't know what it's going to look like. We just hope that we have the ability, initial scholarship wise, to be able to replace those numbers. Because right now, the initial scholarship part is what the issue is of the initial of 25. That's the one thing I think that has to be addressed as we continue to go through these new rules changes. As long as things like that change, where if a kid left, you can replace that. And if you don't do that, we're going to see this major lack of numbers in some programs that it's not going to be a very level playing field at some point. So, but that's for people that are way above my pay grade to make those decisions on. But those are interesting things to talk about, how the initial scholarship of that 25 cap is going to work based on, you know, kids transferring out of your program that have the ability to do that.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up. I did an article on this in December, and I'm going to plan to do another one in the next few weeks. And I really, this actually, I'm going to go on a little, I've got my soapbox here, PJ, for 30 seconds. We saw this in college basketball about 13, 14 years ago because they didn't want people running guys off. And what happened was, all of a sudden, people didn't have scholarships left, and there was nowhere to transfer to because of the initial counter rule. And there were like limitations, and then they blew it out because kids weren't getting the opportunities because there were just empty scholarships that couldn't be used because of the counter rule. And so, of course, with the NCAA, and here's the soapbox part, they will not change the rule until people are adversely affected, even though it's very clear there are going to be hundreds and hundreds of players who are adversely affected. How have you seen this happen in real time? Because there's 1,000 players in the portal right now, something like that. And you probably don't have many or any scholarships like most, correct? Like that, because of your 25 counter. I was just curious how you see that collision happening. And I'm wincing because I really feel like there's going to be a lot of lost opportunity for young men.
You know, I think that's one of the things when you open up something new and it becomes really popular, you start to look at all the advantages, but then there's going to be some things that trickle downhill that might not be so good. And I think that's one of them is, you know, you're going to think everybody who enters the transfer portal is going to have a spot somewhere else. And I don't think that's going to be the case. To your point, with the thousands of students that are in there, student athletes, and everybody thinks they're going to be somewhere. But like anything, I think what it's going to be able to do is it's going to be able to give student athletes an opportunity to do what they feel is best for them, and they get to make that choice. And then from that point forward, I think there's still a lot of data to be seen of how this thing reacts down the road. But that would be one of the concerns for sure.
Let's shift to the Gophers on the field now. You obviously started setting trends in your spring game on Saturday, having two offensive linemen score touchdowns, and big Daniel Falele threw a touchdown pass. So I'm sure that, you know, 390-pound quarterbacks may be the new trend. Give us a glimpse, PJ. You obviously have Tanner Morgan back. He's been a linchpin of your whole program, you know, really since you arrived there. I believe you recruited him to Western, and then he came with you. You had two key opt-outs on your offensive line last year that are back, Daniel being one of them. Just on that offensive side of the ball, Chris Mottman-Bell becomes your new bell cow receiver. And obviously, Muhammad Ibrahim, who missed the spring game because he was observing Ramadan, is the best tailback in the Big Ten coming into the year. Just give us a little glimpse of what you think the identity of this offense can be and its potential.
Well, I think it can be whatever we want it to be. I think we have a lot of experience back, a lot of guys who have played football and have a lot of experience. But I'd say even more of this is what this team has been through, not only having, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic, but the social justice and social injustice here. Movement started right here in the Twin City area, and watching our players be able to deal with that, not only deal with that, but come together and come closer together in a world that it does everything it can to divide us at times, to be able to bring us so close. Our locker room is what the world should look like. And I say that with a very heavy heart and with a lot of passion. You know, this is a very close team. And our whole model this year is TGIF and under one roof and get everybody together, rowing the boat in the same direction, same speed, same efficiency, knowing that we're all different, but rowing towards that same direction. that we all want to go. And that's obviously to win a lot of games, win a championship, influence our community, and then be grateful that we have the opportunity to do it together and create this identity of love and togetherness and hope and doing it for each other and focus on those things. And I think whether it's offensively, defensively, or special teams, this team can be whatever what it wants to be. And we've showed that in spring. There's so many guys here that just love to be here, love being around each other, and have been through a lot. And to have everybody back together from a year that, you know, one game you're missing 33 players. And think about that, 33 players. You're starting so many freshmen. You find a way to win that game on the road. Have that experience built within your program. And not only just with guys missing games, but also guys playing in games that maybe probably played earlier than they should have. So I think that all comes together for this experience. We're an experienced football team. We have a lot of people to be able to spread the ball out to, which is going to be a positive. As long as we keep thinking it and looking at it through very selfless, a very selfless lens. And I think these players have done that.
So defensively, PJ, you add the three transfers. It was a unit that obviously struggled to start the year, but really did show significant improvement by the end. How is that balance between young players who had to grow up fast and obviously the transfers? How have they blended together on that side of the ball?
Well, I think it kind of stems from what I said earlier is about this TGIF and the selfless type mindset. And they all have been. We talked about our depth is our advantage. And I think today in today's world, if you have depth and it's competition, then somebody, two or three people end up leaving. And there's nothing wrong with that. But for us, this team's very selfless. They understand that our depth is our strength, and we need everybody on this football team, especially on the defensive side of the ball, with their experience, with their talent, with their skill set. We need everybody, and be able to have fresh bodies in there all the time gives us the best chance to be successful. And I feel like they see that. That's going to be hopefully one of our big advantages in 2021.
Well, we'll leave you with this question, PJ. The Thursday night of opening weekend of the college football season, you are hosting The Ohio State University. You are a former The Ohio State University graduate assistant, if I recall correctly from the deep recesses of your bio. That, I imagine, will be a giant event in the Twin Cities, a giant event in college football. That's something that's a game people are going to have circle on their calendar for the start of the year. I'm wondering if you can give me a sense of the excitement pushing forward with all the talent you have coming back to have a marquee game like that to open your season.
Well, first of all, I mean, you look at what we're doing, things for like the first time or restorations, things that haven't happened in a long time. We just had the most amount of draft picks in a 2-year back-to-back since the 1970s and 1960s. So we're talking about three possible sellouts in a row here at TCF Bank Stadium. And I think that's really big for our community to know. I hope that, you know, safely we can do that through the CDC and Minnesota Health Department. I hope we're at that time in our society that we're able to do that. And if we're able to do that, it'll be our third straight sellout. We'll be excited to host the Ohio State University here at TCF Bank Stadium. They're a wonderful football team. I'm sure we're going to be big underdogs, but we're going to focus on just getting better every day, keep changing our best, have a great summer, have an elite training camp, and go out there and put the best product on the field we possibly can, hopefully in front of the third straight sellout.
The book is Row the Boat, A True Story with Principles and Lessons to Transform Your Culture by John Gordon and PJ Fleck. Please check it out if you can. And PJ, thanks for taking a few minutes this morning to join us here on the Yahoo Sports College Podcast.
You bet. Means a lot, Pete. Thanks for having me, man. Row the boat, Sky. Ma, go Gophers.
Great stuff there. Keep telling your friends about this. Share us on social media. Subscribe. We're just getting to the fun part. The deep in the off season. Keep listening. Thanks, guys.